colleagues, dear friends, the opportunity to deliver the presidential address at an Eastern Division APA meeting is undoubtedly the highlight of my career, as I'm sure it would be for just about anyone. It's really tragic, therefore, that I'm unable to be there in person to deliver my address. I am so sorry that things worked out this way, but health challenges have prevented me from traveling. And I'm so grateful, on the other hand, to Jeffrey Dunn, Amy Ferrer, and the whole APA staff, the divisional officers, the national board, for arranging me to participate in this remote fashion. I thank Anita Allen for an introduction, which, alas, I could not hear, but which I know, given her carefulness and thoughtfulness, was a very terrific introduction. So without further ado, I want to speak to you today about capitalism and racism. I have posed the question, is capitalism necessarily racist? Which in effect is to say that it is historically and perhaps contingently racist, but is it necessarily racist? So let me start by observing that as a matter of historical fact, capitalism has always been entangled with racial oppression. No one doubts its centrality to the slave-based plantation capitalism of the 19th century. But institutionalized racism was no less fundamental to the social democratic Jim Crow capitalism of the early to mid-20th century. Nor has it lost its structuring force in the deindustrializing subprime mass incarceration capitalism of the present era. Of course, these regimes differ importantly from one another, but all are deeply racialized. Historically speaking, capitalist society in all of its forms to date has been persistently entangled with racial oppression. Now, at first sight, this entanglement appears puzzling. On its face, capitalism should be indifferent to questions of color. Committed to earning as much profit as possible, its firms should seek out the most productive workers regardless of race. Built to maximize efficiency and growth, the system should dissolve racial hierarchies in what Marx and Engels called the icy waters of egotistical calculation. An irrational holdover from pre-capitalist times, racism should disappear from capitalist society. And yet it doesn't. So perhaps the connection between capitalism and racial oppression is not, after all, so fortuitous. Perhaps the view of capitalism as an inherently colorblind economic system is mistaken. Perhaps capitalism itself must be understood differently, as structurally primed to divide populations in ways that correlate with and perhaps even fabricate race. This is the hypothesis I aim to explore in the present lecture. My effort is inspired in part by a new wave of militant anti-racist mobilization in the United States, the Black Lives Matter movement. But it also stands on the shoulders of a long and distinguished tradition of critical theorizing. Often referred to as Black Marxism, this tradition includes such towering figures as C.L.R. James, W.E.B. Du Bois, Eric Williams, Oliver Cromwell Cox, Stuart Hall, Walter Rodney, Angela Davis, Manning Marable, Barbara Fields, Robin Kelly, Sujit Robinson, David Roediger, Cornel West, Adolph Green, and most recently, Kianga Yamada Taylor, among many, many others. Drawing inspiration from their insights, I'm going to make my case here in three steps. First, I'm going to propose what I call an expanded conception of capitalism that, unlike familiar views, discloses the structural basis of its entanglement with racial oppression. Then, having elaborated this conception schematically, I shall proceed in my second step to historicize it. Finally, I'll combine insights from theory and history to draw out the practical political implications for struggles to overcome racial oppression in the 21st century. So I begin by turning to Marx, who offers both helpful insights and unhelpful blind spots. Famously, his view of capitalism penetrates beneath the familiar perspective of commodity exchange to the more fundamental level of commodity production. There, it discovers the secret of accumulation in capital's exploitation of wage laborers. Importantly, these workers are neither serfs nor slaves, but unencumbered individuals, free to enter the labor market and sell their labor power. In reality, of course, they have little actual choice in the matter. Deprived of any direct access to the means of production, they can only secure the means of subsistence by contracting to work for a capitalist in exchange for wages. And the transaction does not redound principally to their benefit. What, from the market perspective, is an exchange of equivalents is, from Marx's perspective, a sleight of hand. Recompensed only for the socially necessary costs of their own reproduction, capitalism's workers have no claim on the surplus value their labor generates, which accrues instead to the capitalist. And that is precisely the point. The crux of the system, on Marx's view, is the exploitative relation between two classes. On the one hand, the capitalists who own the society's means of production and who appropriate its surplus. On the other, the free but propertyless producers who must sell their labor power piecemeal in order to live. Capitalism, on Marx's view, is a social system of class domination centered on the exploitation of free labor by capital in commodity production. Now, this perspective is immensely clarifying as far as it goes, but by itself, it cannot explain why capitalism is deeply entangled with racial oppression. Focused single-mindedly on capital's exploitation of wage labor in commodity production, it marginalizes two equally fundamental processes that are bound up with that one. The first is the crucial role played in capital accumulation by unfree, dependent, and unwaged labor, by which I mean labor that is expropriated as opposed to exploited, subjected to domination, unmediated by a wage contract. The second process concerns the role of political orders in conferring the status of free individuals and citizens on those who are defined as workers, while constituting others as lesser beings, for example, as chattel slaves, indentured servants, colonized subjects, native members of domestic dependent nations, debt peons, and felons. Both these matters, dependent labor and political subjection, are integral to capitalist society and to its entanglement with race. In a nutshell, as I shall explain, the subjection of those whom capital expropriates is a hidden condition of possibility for the freedom of those whom it exploits. Absent an account of the first, we cannot fully understand the second, nor can we fully appreciate the non-accidental character of capitalism's historical entanglement with racial oppression. To develop this claim, I shall utilize an expanded conception of capitalism. In place of the two-level picture Marx gave us, which comprises the familiar level of exchange, plus what he called the hidden abode of exploitation, I shall add a third level, the even more hidden and obfuscated moment of expropriation. By adding this third non-contractual X, as I'll call it, I hope to clarify capitalism's deep-seated entanglement with racial oppression. Let me begin with expropriation. Distinct from Marxian exploitation, expropriation is accumulation by other means. Dispensing with the contractual relation through which capital purchases labor power in exchange for wages, expropriation works by confiscating capacities and resources and conscripting them into capital's circuits of expansion. The confiscation may be blatant and violent, as in New World slavery, or it may be veiled by a cloak of commerce, as in the predatory loans and debt foreclosures of the present era. The expropriated subjects may be rural or indigenous communities in the capitalist periphery, or members of subject or subordinated groups in the capitalist core. Once expropriated, they may end up as exploited proletarians if they are lucky, or if not, as paupers, slum dwellers, sharecroppers, natives, or slaves, subjects of ongoing expropriation outside the wage nexus. The confiscated assets may be labor, land, animals, tools, minerals, or energy deposits, but also human beings, their sexual and reproductive capacities, their children, and bodily organs. What is essential, however, is that the commandeered capacities get incorporated into the value-expanding process that defines capital. Simple theft is not enough. Unlike the sort of pillaging that long predated the rise of capitalism, expropriation in the sense I intend here is confiscation cum conscription into accumulation. Confiscation cum conscription into accumulation. Expropriation in this sense covers a multitude of sins, most of which correlate strongly with racial oppression. The link is clear in practices widely associated with capitalism's early history, but still ongoing, such as territorial conquest, land annexation, enslavement, coerced labor, child abduction, and rape. But expropriation also assumes more modern forms, such as prison labor, transnational sex trafficking, corporate land grabs, and foreclosures on predatory debt, which are also linked to racial oppression, and as we shall see, with contemporary imperialism. But the connection is not just historical. On the contrary, there are structural reasons for capital's ongoing recourse to racialized expropriation. By definition, a system devoted to the limitless expansion and private appropriation of surplus gives the owners of capital a deep-seated interest in confiscating labor and means of production from subject populations. Expropriation raises their profits by lowering costs of production. By supplying cheap inputs, such as energy and raw materials, by providing low-cost means of subsistence, such food and textiles, which permit them to pay lower wages. So by confiscating resources and capacities from unfree or dependent subjects, capitalists can more profitably exploit free workers. And so the two X's, exploitation and expropriation, are intertwined. In the memorable phrase of Jason W. Moore, behind Manchester stands Mississippi. Advantageous even in so-called normal times, expropriation becomes especially appealing in periods of economic crisis when it serves as a critical if temporary fix for restoring declining profitability. The same is true for political crises, which can sometimes be diffused or averted. By transferring value confiscated from populations that appear not to threaten capital to those that do. And that's another distinction that often correlates with race. In general, then, expropriation is a structural feature of capitalism and a disavowed enabling condition for exploitation. Far from representing separate and parallel processes, those two X's are systemically imbricated, deeply intertwined aspects of a single capitalist world system. And the line between them parlays roughly but unmistakably with what Du Bois called the color line. In sum, the expropriation of racialized others constitutes a necessary background condition for the exploitation of workers. I put workers in quotes because many people who are not considered workers obviously work. Let me clarify this idea by contrasting it with Marx's account of so-called primitive or original accumulation, from which it differs in two respects. First, primitive accumulation denotes the bloody process by which capital was initially stockpiled at the system's beginnings. Expropriation, in contrast, designates an ongoing confiscatory process essential for sustaining accumulation in a crisis-prone system. Second, Marx introduces primitive accumulation to explain the historical genesis of the class division between propertyless workers and capitalist owners of the means of production. Expropriation explains that as well, but it also brings into view another social division, equally deep-seated and consequential, but not systematically theorized by Marx. I mean the social division between so-called free workers, whom capital exploits in wage labor, and the unfree or dependent subjects whom it cannibalizes by other means. This second division is crucial to the present inquiry. My thesis is that the racializing dynamics of capitalist society are crystallized in the mark that distinguishes free subjects of exploitation from dependent subjects of expropriation. But to make this case requires a shift in focus from the economic to the political. It is only by thematizing the political order of capitalist society that we can grasp the constitution of that distinction and with it the fabrication of race. Step two, the distinction between expropriation and exploitation is simultaneously economic and political. Viewed economically, these terms name mechanisms of capital accumulation, analytically distinct yet intertwined ways of expanding value. Viewed politically, they have to do with modes of domination, especially with status hierarchies that distinguish rights-bearing individuals and citizens from subject peoples, unfree chattel, and dependent members of families and subordinated groups. In capitalist society, as Marx insisted, exploited workers have the legal status of free individuals, authorized to sell their labor power in return for wages. Once separated from the means of production and proletarianized, they are protected, at least in theory, from further expropriation. In this respect, their status differs sharply from those whose labor, property, and/or persons are still subject to confiscation on the part of capital. Far from enjoying protection, the latter populations are defenseless, fair game for expropriation, again and again. Their expropriability is at bottom exposure, the inability to set limits to what others can do to them, the lack of recourse to political protection. In general, then, the distinction between the two X's is a function not only of accumulation, but also of domination. It is political agencies, above all states, that afford or deny protection in capitalist societies. And it is largely states, too, that codify and enforce the status hierarchies that distinguish citizens from subjects, nationals from aliens, entitled workers from dependent scroungers. Constructing exploitable and expropriable subjects while distinguishing the one from the other, states enable capital to perform its magic of so-called self-expansion. Nevertheless, they do not act alone in this regard. Geopolitical arrangements are implicated as well. What enables political subjectivation at the national level is an international system that recognizes states and authorizes the border controls that distinguish lawful residents from so-called illegal aliens. We need only think of current conflicts surrounding migrants and refugees to see how easily these geopolitically enabled hierarchies of political status become racially coded. The same is true of another set of status hierarchies, which is rooted in capitalism's imperialist geography. That geography divides the world into core and periphery. Historically, the core has appeared to be the emblematic heartland of exploitation, while the periphery was cast as the iconic site of expropriation. That division was explicitly racialized from the get-go, as were the status hierarchies associated with it. Metropolitan citizens versus colonial subjects, free individuals versus slaves, Europeans versus natives, whites versus blacks. These hierarchies, too, serve to distinguish populations and regions suitable for expropriation from those, suitable for exploitation from those destined instead for expropriation. To see how, let's look more closely at political subjectivation, especially at the processes that mark off free exploitable citizen workers from dependent expropriable subjects. Both those statuses were politically constituted, but in different ways. In the capitalist core, dispossessed artisans, farmers, and tenants became exploitable citizen workers through historic processes of class compromise, which channeled their struggles for emancipation onto paths convergent with the interests of capital within the liberal legal frameworks of national states. By contrast, those who became ever expropriable subjects, whether in periphery or core, found no such accommodation. Their uprisings were more often crushed by force of arms. If the domination of the first was shrouded in consent and legality, that of the second rested unabashedly on naked repression. Often, moreover, the two statuses were mutually constituted, effectively co-defining one another. In the United States, the status of citizen workers acquired much of the aura of freedom that legitimates exploitation, by contrast to the dependent, degrading condition of chattel slaves and indigenous peoples, whose persons and lands could be repeatedly confiscated with impunity. In codifying the subject status of the second, the U.S. state simultaneously constructed the normative status of the first. As noted, however, the political fabrication of dependent subjects within capitalism has always exceeded state borders. For systemic reasons, rooted in the intertwined logics of geopolitical rivalry and economic expansionism, powerful states moved to constitute expropriable subjects further afield, in peripheral zones of the capitalist world system. Plundering the furthest reaches of the globe, European colonial powers, followed by a U.S. imperial state, turned billions of people into such subjects, shorn of political protection, ripe and ready for confiscation. The number of expropriable subjects those states created far exceeds the number of citizen workers they emancipated for exploitation. Nor did the process cease with the liberation of subject peoples from colonial rule. On the contrary, masses of new expropriable subjects are created daily, even now, by the joint operations of post-colonial states, their ex-colonial masters, and the trans-state powers that grease the machinery of accumulation, including the global financial institutions that promote dispossession by debt. The common thread here, once again, is political exposure, the incapacity to set limits and invoke protections. Exposure is the deepest meaning of expropriability, the thing that sets it apart from exploitability, and it is expropriability, the condition of being defenseless and liable to violation, that constitutes the core of racial oppression, in my view. It is what distinguishes free subjects of exploitation from dependent subjects of expropriation. So far, I come to the historical point. The case I have made for this proposition is schematic. To put flesh on its bones requires history. Historically, the relation between exploitation and expropriation has undergone several major shifts in the course of capitalist development. In some phases, those two axes were clearly separated from one another, with exploitation centered in European core and reserved for the so-called labor aristocracy, while expropriation was cited chiefly in the periphery and imposed on people of color. Obviously, the so-called labor aristocracy was white and male, European and male. In other phases, by contrast, those separations blurred. Such shifts have periodically reshaped the dynamics of racial oppression in capitalist society, which cannot be understood in abstraction from. What is needed, I think, is an account of capitalism's history as a sequence of regimes of racialized accumulation. Such an account should highlight the historically specific relations between expropriation and exploitation within each principal phase of capitalist development. For each regime, the account should specify the geography and demography of the two axes. To what extent are they separated from one another, cited in different regions and assigned to distinct populations? How exactly are they interimbricated? And what is the relative weight of each in the overall configuration? What forms of political subjectivation characterize a given phase? So here, in this step of my argument, I am going to sketch the very rough outlines of such an account. I begin with the commercial or mercantile capitalism of the 16th through the 18th centuries. This was the phase, in fact, that Marx had in mind when he coined the phrase primitive accumulation. With that phrase, he was signaling that the principal driver of accumulation in this phase of capitalism was not exploitation, but expropriation. Confiscation was the name of the game, manifested both in the land enclosures of the European core and in the conquest, plunder, and, quoting Marx, hunting of black skins, close quote, throughout the periphery, both of which long preceded the rise of modern industry. Prior to large-scale exploitation of factory workers came massive expropriation of bodies, labor, land, and mineral wealth in Europe, and especially in the so-called New World. Expropriation literally dwarfed exploitation in commercial capitalism, and that had major implications for status hierarchy. Certainly, this regime generated precursors of the racializing subjectivation that became so consequential in later phases, Europeans versus natives, free individuals versus chattel, whites versus blacks. But these distinctions were far less sharp in an era when virtually all non-property people had the status of subjects, not that of rights-bearing citizens. In this period, virtually all lacked political protection from expropriation, and the majority condition was not freedom, but dependency. As a result, that status did not carry the special stigma it acquired in subsequent phases of capitalism, when majority ethnicity male workers in the core won liberal rights through political struggle. It was only later, with the democratization of metropolitan states and the rise of large-scale factory-based exploitation of wage labor, that the contrast between free and subject races sharpened, giving rise to the full-blown white supremacist status order that we associate with modern capitalism. That is precisely what happened when mercantile capitalism gave way in the 19th century to what is misleadingly sometimes called liberal capitalism. In this new regime, the two axes became more balanced and interconnected. Certainly, the confiscation of land and labor continued apace as European states consolidated colonial rule, while the U.S. perpetuated its so-called internal colony, first through the extension of racialized slavery, and then after abolition, by transforming freedmen into debt peons through the sharecropping system. Now, however, ongoing expropriation in the periphery entwined with highly profitable exploitation in the core. What was new was the rise of large-scale factory-based manufacturing, which forged the proletariat imagined by Marx, upending traditional life forms and sparking class conflict. Eventually, struggles to democratize metropolitan states delivered a system-confirmed version of citizenship to exploited workers. At the same time, however, brutal repression of anti-colonial struggles ensured continuing subjection in the periphery. So the contrast between dependency and freedom was sharpened and increasingly racialized, mapped onto two categorically different races of human beings. In this way, the free white exploitable citizen worker emerged as the antithetical flip side of its own abjected enabling condition, a dependent, racialized, expropriable subject. And modern racism found a durable anchor in the deep structure of capitalist society. Racialization was further strengthened by the apparent separation of expropriation and exploitation in so-called liberal capitalism. In this regime, the two X's appeared to be sited in different regions and assigned to different populations, one enslaved or colonized, the other free. In fact, however, the division was never so cut and dry, as some extractive industries employed colonial subjects in wage labor, and only a minority of exploited workers in the capitalist core succeeded in escaping ongoing expropriation altogether. Despite their appearance as separate, moreover, the two X's were systemically imbricated. It was the expropriation of populations in the periphery, including the periphery within the core, that supplied the cheap food, textiles, mineral ore, and energy, without which the exploitation of metropolitan industrial workers would not have been profitable. In the so-called liberal era, therefore, the two X's were distinct but mutually calibrated engines of accumulation within a single world capitalist system. The nexus of expropriation and exploitation mutated again in the following era. Begun in the interwar period and consolidated following the Second World War, the new regime of state-managed capitalism softened the separation of the two X's without abolishing it. In this era, expropriation no longer precluded exploitation, but sometimes combined directly with it, as in the segmented labor markets of the capitalist core. In those contexts, capital exacted a confiscatory premium from racialized workers, paying them less than whites and less than the socially necessary costs of their reproduction. Here, accordingly, expropriation articulated directly with exploitation, entering into the internal constitution of wage labor. African Americans are a case in point. Displaced by agricultural mechanization and flocking to northern cities, many joined the industrial proletariat, but chiefly as second-class workers consigned to the dirtiest, most menial jobs. In this era, their exploitation was overlaid by expropriation, as capital failed to pay the full costs of their reproduction. What undergirded that arrangement was their continuing political subjection under Jim Crow. Throughout the era of state-managed capitalism, Black Americans were deprived of political protection, as segregation, disfranchisement, and countless other institutionalized humiliations continued to deny them full citizenship. Even when employed in northern factories, they were still constituted as more or less expropriable, not as fully free bearers of rights. They were expropriated and exploited simultaneously. Even as it muddied the line between those two X's, the state capitalist regime heightened the status differential associated with them. Newly created welfare states in the capitalist core lent additional symbolic and material value to the status of citizen worker as they expanded protections and benefits for those who could claim it. Instituting labor rights, corporate bargaining, and social insurance, they not only stabilized accumulation to capital's benefit, but also politically incorporated those workers who were, let us say, merely exploited. The effect, however, was to intensify the invidious comparison with those excluded from that designation, further stigmatizing racialized others. Conspicuously anomalous and lived as unjust, the latter's continuing vulnerability to violation became the target of sustained militant protest in the aftermath of the war, culminating in the 1960s as civil rights and black power activists took to the streets. In the periphery, meanwhile, struggles for decolonization exploded, giving rise in due course to a different amalgamation of the two exes. Independence promised to raise the status of ex-colonials from dependent subjects to right-bearing citizens. In the event, some working class strata did manage to achieve that elevation, but precariously and on inferior terms. In a global economy premised on unequal exchange, their exploitation too was suffused with expropriation. As trade regimes tilted against them, siphoned value away to the core, notwithstanding the overthrow of colonial rule. Moreover, the limited advances enjoyed by some were denied to the vast majority who remained outside the wage nexus and subject to overt confiscation. Now, however, the expropriators were not only foreign governments and transnational firms, but also post-colonial states. Centered largely on import substitution and industrialization, the latter's development strategies often entailed expropriation of their own indigenous populations. And even those developmental states that made serious efforts to improve the condition of peasants and workers could not fully succeed. The combination of straitened state resources, neo-imperial regimes of investment and trade, and ongoing land dispossession ensured that the line between the two X's would remain fuzzy in the post-colony. In state-managed capitalism, therefore, exploitation no longer appears so separate from expropriation. Rather, the two X's became internally articulated in racialized industrial labor on one hand and in compromised post-colonial citizenship on the other. Nevertheless, the distinction between the two X's did not disappear, and pure variants of each persisted in core and periphery. Substantial populations were still expropriated pure and simple, and they were almost invariably people of color. Others were merely exploited, and they were more likely to be European and white. What was new, however, was the emergence of hybrid cases in which some people were subject simultaneously to both expropriation and exploitation. Such people remained a minority under state-managed capitalism, but they were the heralds of the world to come. When we turn to the present regime, we see a vast expansion of the expropriation-exploitation hybrid. This phase, which I shall call financialized capitalism, rests on a novel and distinctive nexus. On the one hand, there has been a dramatic shift in the geography and demography of the two X's. Much large-scale industrial exploitation now occurs outside the historic core, in the BRICS countries and semi-periphery. At the same time, expropriation is on the rise, so much so, in fact, that it threatens to outpace exploitation once again as a source of value. These two developments are closely connected. As industry migrates and finance migrates, metastasizes, expropriation is becoming universalized, afflicting not only its traditional subjects, but also those who were previously shielded by their status as citizen workers and free individuals. Debt is a major culprit here, as global financial institutions pressure states to collude with investors in extracting value from defenseless populations. It is largely by means of debt that peasants are dispossessed. Corporate land grabs are intensified in the capitalist periphery, but they are not the only victims. Virtually all non-property post-colonials are expropriated by a sovereign debt, as post-colonial states in hock to international lenders and caught in the vias of structural adjustment are forced to abandon developmentalism in favor of liberalizing policies which transfer wealth to corporate capital and global markets. Far from reducing debt, moreover, the restructuring only compounds it, sending the ratio of debt service to GNP soaring skyward and condemning countless generations to expropriation, some long before they are born, and regardless of whether or not they are also subject to exploitation. It is increasingly by expropriation, too, that exploitation proceeds in the historic core. As low-wage precarious service work replaces unionized industrial labor, wages fall below the socially necessary costs of reproduction. Workers who used to be merely exploited are now expropriated, too. That doubled condition, previously reserved for minorities but now becoming generalized, is compounded by the assault on the welfare state. The social wage declines as tax revenues previously dedicated to public infrastructure and social entitlements are diverted to debt service and deficit reduction in the hopes of placating the markets. Even as real wages plummet, services that used to be provided publicly are offloaded onto families and communities, which is to say, chiefly onto women, who are meanwhile employed in precarious wage work, hence exploited and expropriated coming and going. In the core, moreover, as in the periphery, a race to the bottom drives down corporate taxes, further depleting state coffers and apparently justifying more austerity, in effect completing the vicious circle. Additional corporate giveaways eviscerate hard-won labor rights, setting up once-protected workers for violation. Yet they, like others, are still expected to buy cheap stuff made elsewhere. In these conditions, continued consumer spending requires expanded consumer debt, which fattens investors while expropriating citizen workers of every color, but especially racialized borrowers, who are steered to hyper-expropriative subprime and payday loans. At every level and in every region, debt is the engine driving major new waves of expropriation in financialized capitalism. In the present regime, then, we encounter a new entwinement of exploitation and expropriation, and a new logic of political subjectivation. In place of the earlier sharp divide between dependent expropriable subjects and free exploitable workers, there now appears a continuum. At one end lies the growing mass of defenseless expropriable subjects. At the other, the dwindling ranks of protected citizen workers, subject only to exploitation. At its center sits a new figure, formally free but acutely vulnerable, the expropriated and exploited citizen worker. No longer restricted to peripheral populations and racial minorities, this new figure is becoming the norm. Nevertheless, the expropriation-exploitation continuum remains racialized, as people of color are still disproportionately represented at the expropriative end of the spectrum. They remain racialized and far more likely than others to be poor, unemployed, homeless, hungry, and sick, to be victimized by crime and predatory loans, to be incarcerated and sentenced to death, to be harassed and murdered by police, to be used as cannon fodder or sex slaves, and turned into refugees or collateral damage in endless wars. I come to my concluding political reflections. Throughout its history, capitalism has always been entangled with racial oppression. The reasons remain obscure when capitalism is understood narrowly as an economic system centered on the exploitation of free labor in commodity production. Seen that way, it defies understanding why a social formation for which profit is the end all and be all should be so enduringly pervaded by systemic racism. The mystery dissolves, however, as soon as we view capitalism broadly as an institutionalized social order that encompasses not only an official economy, but also a political order that renders its economy possible. When we adopt that expanded conception, we gain access to deep-seated institutional arrangements that anchor racial oppression in capitalist society. What becomes visible specifically is the ongoing importance of expropriation to capital accumulation. Throughout its history, capitalism has consistently relied on expropriation, both to enable exploitation and as a mechanism of accumulation in its own right. Neither an aberration nor a pre-capitalist vestige, expropriation is as central to capital's self-expansion as the exploitation whose profitability it undergirds. Indeed, the mutual implication of the two X's is among the defining features of capitalist society and the key to understanding its persistent entanglement with racial oppression. What ties that nexus to race is not just economics, however, but the political order of capitalist society. Political powers, both domestic and international, have always supplied indispensable preconditions for accumulations. Property rights and repressive forces, to be sure, but also the legally entrenched hierarchies of status that mark off free individuals who can exchange their labor power for wages from unfree or dependent subjects whose assets can simply be seized. Codifying that division, capitalism's political orders have cast the first group as rights-bearing citizens entitled to state protection, while positioning the second as inherently violable others, bereft of political defenses and exposed to predation. Exactly where and how that line is drawn varies historically according to the regime of accumulation, but status hierarchies dividing the merely exploitable from the flat-out expropriable have been present in one form or another in every phase of capitalist development, and they have corresponded in every phase to the color line. In each regime, the social division that most consistently distinguishes free subjects of exploitation from dependent subjects of expropriation is race. It is tempting to conclude that race just is the mark of that distinction capitalist societies. But this feature of capitalist society has faithfully shaped the grammar of social struggle within and against it. The racialized separation of the two X's has encouraged the so-called free workers of the capitalist core to dissociate their interests and aims from those of dependent subjects in the periphery, including the periphery within the core. As a result, what has been understood as class struggle has been all too easily disconnected from struggles against slavery, imperialism, and racism when not posed directly against them. And the converse has also been true. Movements seeking to overcome racial oppression have sometimes despaired of alliances with labor when they have not altogether disdained them. The effect throughout capitalism's history has been to weaken the forces of emancipation. The analysis I've been developing here suggests the pressing need to overcome these separations. Contra traditional understandings of socialism, an exclusive focus on exploitation cannot emancipate working people of any color. It is also necessary to target expropriation, to which exploitation is in any case tied. By the same token, contra liberalism, racism cannot be defeated exclusively by legal reform, nor Pache nationalism by enterprise zones, community control, or self-determination. What is needed, rather, is to overcome capitalism's stubborn nexus of expropriation and exploitation, to transform the overall matrix, to eradicate both of capitalism's X's by abolishing the larger system that generates their symbiosis. What are the prospects for such a radicalism today? The perspective I've outlined here suggests a mixed prognosis. On the one hand, financialized capitalism has softened the mutual separation of the two X's, as industrial production is relocated to the semi-periphery, and as financialization universalizes debt, capitalism's long-standing practice of assigning exploitation to one group and expropriation to another is giving way to a more complex configuration. As the current issue subjects growing swaths of humanity to both of those X's at once, the structural basis of racial oppression appears to be breaking down. In theory, then, the prospects for cross-racial alliances should be improving, as should the chances for integrated struggles against both exploitation and expropriation, and indeed against the broader social system that lives off their imprecation. On the other hand, the actual political landscape is hardly so rosy. Racial oppression persists even within the fuzzier contours of the present regime, and the new configuration may actually aggravate racial antagonism, at least in the short run. When centuries of stigma and violation meet capital's voracious need for subjects to exploit and expropriate, the result is intense insecurity and even paranoia, hence a desperate scramble for safety, and in some cases exacerbated racism. Certainly, those who were previously shielded from much predation are less than eager to share the burden of it now, and not simply because they are racist, although some of them surely are. It is also that they too have legitimate grievances which come out in one way or another, as well they should. In the absence of a cross-racial movement to abolish a social system that imposes near universal expropriation, their grievances find expression in the growing ranks of right-wing authoritarian populism. Those movements, which flourish in virtually every country of capitalism's historic core and in many countries of its periphery as well, those movements represent the entirely predictable response to what I've called the progressive neoliberalism that cynically appeals to fairness while extending expropriation, asking those who were once protected from the worst by their standing as whites or Europeans to give up that favorite status, embrace their growing precarity, and surrender to violation, all while funneling their assets to investors and offering them nothing in return beyond moral approval. In the dog-eat-dog world of financializing capitalism, cross-racial alliances do not emerge spontaneously from the new, more blurred configuration of the two X's. Nevertheless, such alliances may be constructed through sustained political effort. The scene is a perspective that stresses the symbiosis of exploitation and expropriation in financialized capitalism. By disclosing their mutual imbrication, such perspectives suggest that neither X can be overcome on its own. Their fate is tied together, as is that of the populations who were once so sharply divided and are now so uncomfortably close. Today, when the exploited are also the expropriated, and vice versa, it might be possible to envision an alliance among them. Perhaps in blurring the line between the two X's, financialized capitalism is creating the material basis for their joint abolition. But it's nevertheless up to us to seize the day and to turn a historical possibility into a real historical force for emancipation. Thank you very, very much for your attention. And again, my profoundest apologies for not being able to be there with you in person. Goodbye.